to the Third Opinion. I'm here in the studio with Associate Professor Maurie Brigel. Welcome, Maurie.
Hello.
Well, there you go. Maurie graduated from medicine at Melbourne University in what year was that?
1964.
That was a good year. He trained in anaesthetics in London and became an anaesthetic registrar at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, but he found he was really interested in surgery, so he trained again at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and attained the surgical fellowship of the Royal Australian College of Surgeons. Initially, he practiced all types of surgical procedures, but was inspired to concentrate on hernias and several other things. But you said that you have done 10,000 hernia surgeries. Is that correct, Maurie?
That's right.
Is that a world record?
Definitely not.
Okay. Maurie now, he is working, teaching students, international students, in medicine, and he has many stories from his past. So we thought we would take some time to explore the sometimes not so sexy world of surgery, hernia, hemorrhoids, skin cancers, ingrown toenails, and testicular torsions. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Maurie, first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself. Why did you become a doctor?
Well, like many of the children of immigrants, we went to schools like University High School or Melbourne High School, and we were all wanted to achieve, and medicine was a very popular profession, and my colleagues and my fellow students, we all wanted to become professionals, and so medicine appealed to me, and so I decided to try out at that.
And how did you go in that? Like, how did that work for you as a career through your life?
Well, I've been very happy as a doctor. I've been very happy with my career. And I suppose it's been successful in many ways. We all have our ups and downs, some of our failures, but we have our successes as well. And we like to help people. And so I'm now... I've retired from active surgery, but I'm pursuing educational activities in a fairly intense manner, developing teaching programs, publishing books, and running workshops. Particularly in the last few years, we've started doing it on Zoom. So I've learned how to do PowerPoints, how to insert videos, how to record them. And we use that for teaching for doctors here in Melbourne and doctors all over Australia and even internationally.
Fantastic. How rewarding is it to being a teacher instead of being a surgeon for you?
Well, when I gave up operating, I didn't miss the operating that much, but I missed the patient contact and the contact with other doctors. And teaching these international medical graduates and others as well gives you contact with your colleagues. They're usually younger, much younger, and they're all very pleasant. And the international medical graduates are particularly keen to learn because their future depends on it. And it's not that easy for them to pass. You know, 30% of the Australian workforce are international medical graduates from all around the world. Some of them don't speak English that well. Some of them are hard to understand. So I try to tutor them and mentor them to improve their different skills and how to pass the exam.
Fantastic. So it sounds like you've got a career that you never have to retire from.
That's right. And a lot of my colleagues, unfortunately, that's what's missing a lot. They retire from medicine and they say nothing more at all to do with medicine. Well, I've taken a different attitude to it. Maybe they play bridge, they play golf and bowls. And actually, bowls were the worst patients I had because when I tried to arrange a hernia operation with them, they could never have the hernia operation because they were busy with the bowls. The finals were coming up and they couldn't take time off. They were addicts.
I might get involved here, Eva. Yes, they are addicts. You can never get them clear of a Saturday or a Sunday. Or
worse than morphine.
So tell me about, you were a hernia specialist. And I'm very interested in hernia because I've only had one operation in my whole life, and that was when I was 1 year old in the Catskill Mountains, and I was crying, and my mother didn't know what was wrong with me, and then she saw it. She saw a lump. And fortunately, my mother is a very wise and very attentive mother, but other parents sometimes don't know this in a baby, why they're crying. So could you tell me a little bit about hernias and why do babies get hernias to start off with?
Well, babies commonly get hernias, and they're mostly male babies who get inguinal, that's in the groin hernias. There are a couple of different type of groin hernias, what called inguinal and femoral. You probably had a femoral, but we can't be sure.
I know I did.
And what happens, hernias occur in what weak spots in the abdominal wall. And the weak spots are in the groin and in the femoral canal in the groin where the vessels leave and go into the leg. And so there's a hole there, and sometimes a bit of bowel comes down. And the thing about femoral hernias and inguinal hernias in babies and children is they very frequently strangulate. So they have to be operated on straight away. In the newborn, hernias, you were probably born, say, a term, but many babies are born, or male babies are born before term, when the testis hasn't descended and what's called a peritoneal sac is still open. So a hernia can easily develop in that and become strangulated and even cause necrosis of the testis. So it's important to diagnose these, and you're right. The symptom for a baby having a hernia is the baby crying for an unexplained reason. So any baby who cries, and I'm not a pediatric surgeon, I never operated on babies, just an occasional bris, which terrified me. I would say that hernias in babies are an emergency and they need to be dealt with straight away.
What can go wrong if a baby doesn't get to have the surgery straight away?
Well, hernias can be what's called irreducible. That means you can't push them back in. And they can be strangulated. That means the blood supply is cut off. And whatever's in the hernia, and it could be fat, it could be in girls, femoral hernias in babies have often got their ovary in it, and I've seen cases like that. And that can strangulate, or if there's bowel there, it can strangulate and you can die from it. The baby can die.
Okay, so the first learning we have for the audience is if you have a child or a grandchild and they're crying inconsolably to check their groin. And what you're looking for is a lump.
Yeah.
Is it visible or would you have to feel
it? Well, it depends. It's usually visible, but when they cry. Okay, so it pops out.
It can pop out and go back in.
Yeah, that's a reducible hernia.
Okay.
And that's when the hernia goes back in, it's called a reducible hernia. But when it stays out, it's called an irreducible hernia. And an irreducible hernia can then strangulate. And that means the blood supply is cut off, might have bowel in it, and the bowel can perforate and die. You get peritonitis and die. And it still does happen.
Wow. Thank you. So how about in adults? Is this common in adults as well?
Yes, 25% approximately of males get a groin or an abdominal wall hernia. A very high percentage.
25%?
Yep.
Wow, that's...
And so...
that's one in four,
isn't it? That's how I got to do 10,000 hernias, because they're very common. And there's one on each side.
Yeah.
Okay.
You've got more risk, don't you, of having on the other side if you've had on one side?
Yeah, if you get a hernia on one side, there's about a 17% chance you'll get another hernia on the other side at some stage.
Sean, do you have any friends that have had hernias?
Well, I was just thinking of the statistic there. Only one or two, but not one in four. But I suppose...
Not yet.
That's right, we haven't hit that magic number yet.
Not everybody has an operation for a hernia, by the way.
Yeah.
I've seen 90 or 100 years old patients who've had a hernia for 20 or 30 years and nothing's happened. But our scientific research shows that if you've got a small hernia... which is asymptomatic, after 2 years, nothing might happen. But after 4 or 5 years, most patients decide to have the operation because they develop some symptoms.
I have one cousin who's had multiple operations for hernia. I can't mention his name, of course. But, yes, I'm thinking of all the people that have... and my late dad had a hernia. That's right. Yeah,
okay.
Forever.
Well, there you are. Yeah, there a big are. Percentage of your all now life.
Now the numbers are coming out. Yeah.
So okay. That
well, the other, there are other types of hernias, not just in the groin. The other type of hernias that occur in the belly button, umbilical hernias. Mm-hmm. And the other very important one and debilitating type of hernia is called an incisional hernia.
Mm-hmm.
An incisional hernia is one which occurs where you've previously had an abdominal operation, such as bowel cancer or peritonitis, for, say, appendicitis or diverticulitis. You have an operation and the wound breaks down, weakens, and eventually you get this massive bulge, which may cause problems and can strangulate also.
Has laser surgery changed the way that you treat hernias?
What type of surgery?
Laser. Do you use lasers?
No, we don't use laser. That's a bit of a misconception. Mm-hmm. You're talking about laparoscopic hernia repair.
Keyhole
surgery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it has changed surgery immensely. The first keyhole surgery was gallbladder surgery, and it really revolutionized surgery. Prior to that, for a gallbladder operation, patients would stay in hospital 7 or 8 days. They'd often be very sick and get a wound breakdown, etc. And, you know, so keyhole surgery has been revolutionary and also revolutionized hernia surgery. But I don't do laparoscopic surgery. I'm a bit old-fashioned, but I believe what the technique I use is superior. I did all my hernia operations under local anesthetic with sedation. And I was inspired to do this by a visiting surgeon in the 1980s called Lichtenstein, who came from America and described his technique of using mesh. And most hernia repair these days use mesh. Mm-hmm. And that can be a little controversial, but I would say the vast majority use a mesh. And keyhole surgery, laparoscopic hernia repair, you have to use a mesh. And usually that's done under a general anesthetic. Whereas hernia repair, what is called the open hernia repair, can be done under local anaesthetic and with a mesh usually.
So that would really reduce the time in hospital, would it, anaesthetic?
I did a survey of my patients and published the results, and the majority of patients went home the same day.
Oh,
they'd come in the morning, and because the local anaesthetic lasted for 7 or 8 hours, they were able to move around easily, and they were safer at home. I even did 90-year-olds and sent them home the same day. They were safer at home. They need to have somebody with them at night, just in case they got out of bed and fainted. But it was more dangerous to faint out of bed in hospital because you didn't have your wife or spouse next to you, whereas in home you had somebody who could look after you immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't the first one to use this technique, but it was popular overseas with some groups. I visited a few centres to look at how they did it differently and decided which way I wanted to do it.
Murray, so is there anyone else doing that now? Are they doing local anaesthetic?
Well, I don't want to advertise.
But is
yes, there is.
It is still.
The main one is my colleague who I inspired to do it. That's Charles Lycrum, who works with me.
Okay.
And he does about 400 hernia operations a year now, mostly under local anaesthetic with sedation. So we can tailor it as well. Unfortunately, some anaesthetists are not aware of the technique and they're scared to take part in it, so you have to even choose the anaesthetist who knows what you want to do and trusts you.
Okay. And his number, just joking. Excellent. So
we do have a website if you're interested.
Yes.
If you're interested in what I do, I have a website called www.hernia.net.au. It's called the Melbourne Hernia Clinic. I also have a hemorrhoid website.
We'll get on to hemorrhoids in a minute, but let's finish hernias first. Hernia.com.au, good name.
Hernia.net.au. I'm going to look it up now.
But there's other material on there. I use it as an educational vehicle.
Yeah.
I have PowerPoint presentations on skin cancer and cysts and lipomas, all those sort of things that I used to do in my practice.
Yeah.
Now, I'll point out that things have changed a lot in surgery. When I started surgery, I would do all different types of operations, gallbladder operations, hernia operations, breast operations, thyroid operations. That type of surgeon now is a bit of a dinosaur. There's not many general surgeons in Melbourne who do all the different types of operations. Now it's become very specialised. And so you could almost say that hernia surgery, and that's what Charles calls himself, he calls himself a hernia specialist because that's the only operation he does. Mm. And so and that's how, it's just like orthopaedic surgeons now only do shoulders and knees, or shoulders and wrists, or hips and knees. So orthopaedic surgery has become very specialised. We know that the more operations of the one type you do, the more experience you have, the slicker you get at it. And time is very important in surgery, because if you're exposed to an anaesthetic for 4 hours instead of 2 hours, the risks go up. Mm. In older patients, for example, you may have a little bit of dementia or Alzheimer's, which people don't notice. But after a general anaesthetic, it may come to light. And this is one of the fears. And that's one of the reasons why I particularly like local anaesthetic, particularly in the elderly.
But on the other hand, is it a problem because so many people have become specialists and they can't do general surgery, and therefore around the country we've got a lack of general surgeons?
It is a very big problem, yeah. Getting into the right doctor. Mm. Now, you know, if you have contacts, you get into the right doctor and this and that. But for the average person, getting an appointment with the right specialist who has an overall point of view, I don't know whether I should quote this patient or this example. The examples that I have are, for example, a patient goes to a surgeon with a lump in the groin and a swollen leg. The surgeon says, oh, it's not a hernia. Go back to your general practitioner, or I'm not doing anything else. So they go then to a vascular surgeon because they've got a swollen leg. The vascular surgeon says, oh, it's not my field, it's not vascular, go away. Then they go to a cardiologist who says a swollen leg, but it's not your heart, go away. Eventually, somebody does a CAT scan, a GP, mind you, and they find a mass in the pelvis. So an inflammatory mass, fortunately. Mm. So this is a problem, going to the right doctor who has a broad view. And in that's the issue with physicians now. There are very few general physicians, very good general physicians, who can sort out and look after your whole body. I suppose that should be really the role of a general practitioner. Mm. But the way general practices run, with bulk billing clinics, and time being such a vital aspect and the shortage of doctors, then this can become an issue.
So there's this fragmenting of medicine into subspecialties.
Yeah.
Is there a general surgeon anymore? Or is everyone a general surgeon to start off with, and then it moves into specialty very quickly? How does the system work?
I'm not involved in the training programs anymore, but more and more you get trained. You might do a general fellowship, then you go into a special area. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you get it. Depends on the different categories and what you get into. And it depends, you know, it's very hard to become a surgeon these days because it's a lot of competition to get into a training program. So surgeons or potential surgeons might do 2 or 3 years just doing anything in surgery, and then they get into their program and they might do upper colon or lower colon.
Oh, it's that specific?
Very specific.
Wow, okay.
If you've got a cancer of the pancreas, which is so common in the Jewish community now, you go to a surgeon who's done a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And so you have to, it's good to be knowledgeable and have a GP who has good contacts who can advise you in the right way.
Has there ever been a rush on hernias?
A rush on hernias. There was after the COVID, by the way.
There was?
There was a built-up demand.
Okay,
An unimaginable demand. Okay. So there was a rush. Yeah. There wasn't a fire sale either.
Well, I'm looking at the website and it looks like I can even log into one of your Zoom classes, can I? Or do I have to register?
Yes, you probably can.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So if anyone wants to brush up on their hernia or... information, you can go on to the Melbourne Hernia Clinic and hear Maurie speak there, and there's different dates.
Well, in actual fact, there's some videos there about hernias which I made for SBS Radio some years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. All about your hernia.
Okay, so let's move on to the next interesting area, which is hemorrhoids.
Hey.
Another sexy topic.
I mentioned to somebody today that I was going to be asked about hemorrhoids. They said, "You're not going to talk about hemorrhoids on the radio, are you?" But I know you're dying to talk about it. Do you must suffer from that problem yourself?
I don't, but I'm sure I have friends that do. So if you're out there listening, this is the time to listen really carefully.
Well, it's a common problem in pregnancy, actually.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's true. Tell me, so when do you operate? When is hemorrhoids a problem? Because obviously people have many different degrees of, in the same way with hernias. I mean, with hernias, it's quite simple, isn't it? It's reducible or irreducible. Is it the same thing with hemorrhoids?
Well, there are reducible and irreducible hemorrhoids.
Mm-hmm.
So we grade hemorrhoids according to their severity, 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the grade 1 and 2, you usually will respond to conservative treatment. So the general practitioner can advise you on fibre gel, diet, etc. And I have quite a lot of experience with hemorrhoids because that was one of the things I often used to do in my office,
mm-hmm.
deal with it again. And but often a hemorrhoid which is prolapsing, diet and some oral medication such as fibre gel will stop the prolapse and give you a good result without requiring surgery.
So that's secondary to people being constipated. Is that why?
Constipation, straining at the bowel, and diet. Mm-hmm. Our modern diet with bran or no bran, etc., lends to a prevalence of hemorrhoids. But, you know, first of all, not all symptoms in that anal region are hemorrhoids.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be quite clear about that. But generally speaking, people on my website, we get a lot of people, and I don't do them anymore, but they write in. People are a bit worried about when they've got hemorrhoids, they're a bit scared to go to, especially the men, a bit scared to go to a GP. They're a bit nervous about it. So they like to actually look at the internet,
mm-hmm.
and they send me an email and I refer them off to another surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of surgeons who deal with it. That specific area. So then you get you've got the hemorrhoids, they're not responding to conservative measure. The main symptoms can be with hemorrhoids, if they can be painful,
mm-hmm.
when they thrombose, that means they get a clot, they can be very painful, or they can be itchy, or they can bleed. So the next type of treatment is rubber band ligation.
It's good that this is radio only, isn't it? Because
yes.
We don't have to.
Well,
people just have to use their imaginations.
Yeah. Well, the lump. The other treatment is rubber band ligation,
mm-hmm.
where you put rubber bands on, and that avoids going into hospital usually.
Mm, really.
And it can be done in the office by people who are experienced at it. And it's quite successful. It doesn't always cure, but it certainly can relieve the symptoms. And then the final treatment, if that's not working, is surgery.
Mm.
But I felt, I know you've been asking me about preventative and important things.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when somebody has bleeding from the bottom,
mm-hmm.
they have to be quite careful that it's not a cancer of the
mm-hmm.
bowel.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bleeding of hemorrhoids is pretty typical, that it spurts into the pan and it's blood on the toilet paper. But if the blood is mixed with the feces, that's a warning sign that it could be a higher up polyp or a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the worrying things about bowel rectal cancer and bowel mm-hmm. cancer is that the incidence in younger people is increasing. And quite by a significant proportion. I can't give you the exact figures. So if you're just a 40-year-old and you think, oh, I'm too young for bowel cancer, you can still have bowel cancer. So it's important that this is checked.
Mm.
Now, older people, and routinely now, the government have a policy of what's called occult blood. In other words, there's blood in your feces, but you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And these tests can detect that blood. And this is a government-run scheme. I think every 2 years, between the ages of 50 to 75, and it's been shown to improve cancer survival rate because it's detected earlier. So I think this is a very important message for everybody.
So for all those people who have got that little packet at home and they haven't used it for the last two, three, four, 5 years,
they should
just do it. And this
and
show is
one of the problems. That's one of the problems with the program. The people are not doing it.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm talking about it.
Well, you should either, because I did it when I got my first kit at the age of 50.
Yeah.
And it showed some polyps. And once we had the investigation and the polyps were removed.
Well, the thing.
And I go every 2 years now. And it's been fine since. And that's a long time ago.
So, it's if you've got this positive test, about 20 to 30% of people who have the colonoscopy have got nothing wrong. Nothing is found. Another 20 to 30% might have hemorrhoids. Then you might have, say, 20% who either have a polyp or a cancer. And so, if you detect a polyp early, it won't turn cancerous, and they remove it. And if it's an early cancer, you also survive and avoid the necessity for chemotherapy and radiotherapy. So it's a very worthwhile procedure.
How often does a polyp convert into a tumour?
That's a bit of a hard figure to say. There are people who have multiple polyps and they quite commonly convert into a tumour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but whereas a normal polyp might take years.
Mm-hmm.
So... and there's a condition called familial polyposis, and it's also important the family history. If you've got a family history of bowel cancer or polyps, then you need to also be checked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think there's some really important learnings there. So if you're out there listening and you've been avoiding doing those tests, it makes a huge difference in terms of outcomes. And even though the percentage of risk is small, if you know about it, you can do something about it and the outcomes will change your life.
On that note, we might take a 2 or 3 minute break. Give Murray a break there because he hasn't stopped talking, which is fantastic. Murray wanted some Neil Diamond, so I found Cracklin Rosie, after my wife Rosie, of course, your sister, and we'll play that for a sec, and then we'll be back. All right, you're listening to The Third Opinion on J-Air. On The Third Opinion, and we've got a third person here today, which is good. We've got Murray, Murray.
Three opinions, and he has opinions on many interesting things, which you normally don't talk about in public spaces. So we're intentionally doing that because making people feel comfortable to talk about their hemorrhoids, their hernias, and now we have skin cancers, ingrown toenails, and testicular torsion. Sian, which one would you like to know about?
Let's start on the easy one, skin cancer.
Okay.
Testicular torsion, we'll finish on that. Might be enough for 1 week. So, Murray, skin cancer, is it getting worse in this country?
Yes. And it's getting diagnosed at an earlier stage. Some problem, and there's been some really big advances in the treatment of melanoma. It's a very important subject for every person. Australia is the skin, and Queensland is the skin cancer capital of the world. We have an enormous amount of skin cancer because of our race, because of the sun, and because of everybody loving to be in the sun and getting burnt. The biggest risk, of course, due to family, there's a family risk if you've got a family with skin cancer, but there are other risks, but the biggest risk is getting burnt as a child or a youngster. And we've, of course, taken steps to overcome that, but you still see everybody burning in the sun, or many people burning in the sun.
Yes, I remember badly being burnt at Portsea Back Beach when I was about 6 years old. I've never forgiven my parents for that. But I'm right, I haven't developed any skin cancers.
So what's evolved in Australia as the skin cancer rates go up? Now, there are three different types of skin cancer. Melanoma is the worst type.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have what's called a squamous cell carcinoma, which is, can be pretty bad. And then you have what is called a basal, and can kill you. But then you have a basal cell carcinoma, which is by far the commonest, but it doesn't kill you, but it can cause damage by gnawing away into your nose or other parts if it's left out of control. And that's why it's called a rodent ulcer, because it gets eaten. You get eaten like by a mouse. You get a large ulcer. And you wouldn't believe we still see patients like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the issues, I think, with skin cancer is who do you go to and how do you get a check? So, and that has also evolved over the years. Before, you had a general practitioner who may or may not diagnose it. He didn't have a dermatoscope. And that's a very big advance, dermoscopy, and that's another subject in its own right.
Mm.
So you go to a GP, he may or may not treat you or refer you to a colleague in his practice. He may refer you to a plastic surgeon. He may refer you to a dermatologist, or he may refer you even to somebody like myself when I used to do it, but I didn't do a lot of skin cancer. But now, so what happened, it became expensive and it became difficult to get in to see a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist. Although I must say that the skin specialists now are triaging. I've referred patients to a skin specialist and they say, send me a photo, we'll look at it and we'll see how urgent it is.
Mm.
So medicine has changed tremendously. Mm. And so what has happened, however, and I think this has been a good advance, is that the groups of doctors, and they were smart businessmen, decided to learn more about general practitioners, teach general practitioners more about skin cancer. And these general practitioners only dealt with skin cancer, and skin cancer clinics were formed. So that these doctors, whilst they're not surgeons, and there's a big debate about this, of course, who should call themselves surgeons in Australia now because of what happened with the cosmetic surgery scandals, that these doctors are good at dermoscopy. And the idea of dermoscopy is to look at something that is suspicious. And if it's suspicious, then you deal with it by some type of biopsy, either a punch biopsy, a shave biopsy, or an excisional biopsy. So that's a very important way of managing it. And these doctors know how to do it. So it's like everything. You might get a plastic surgeon who's not really that great at skin cancer diagnosis, or you might get a dermatologist who's not that good at the surgical part of it. So you try to choose who you think the most appropriate person is for a particular lesion.
I went to one of those skin specialist clinics and I felt very well cared for. He took photos. He knew he had his little machine there, that what's it called? A dermoscope?
Yes, dermatoscope. Dermoscopy.
And it was just so targeted, and then come back in a year or come back in 2 years and they've got all the data there.
Well once so again, it's the idea of specialisation.
Yeah.
So these are, in a way, specialists. But the problem is they do go to courses, and I'm involved in some of the courses with a company, one of the companies I work with. I don't actually teach the skin cancer part. I do other parts. And these people get a tremendous amount of guidance. They get diplomas and they get all sorts of things. So they become very knowledgeable, more than the average GP.
Yes.
Doesn't mean they're always good.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, I would rely on their diagnosis and advice. And then you can always seek a second opinion.
And in Australia, you say that no matter how much they're educating people, the slip, slop, slap and other strategies, do you think that using skin creams and other ways to stop skin cancers emerging, do you think it's helped to use plus?
Well, it's well shown that they do reduce the incidence of skin cancers. Yes.
And do you think that's being used enough in Australia? Do you think that other...
I'm not an epidemiologist. I can't really tell you. Some people use it and some people don't, you know. But you know what? You know, you can even... When you go down the beach, I've had occasion to spotting people on the beach who've got melanomas and told them so, and sent them off to somebody for treatment.
It's kind of like bird spotting, isn't it? Melanoma spotting at the beach.
So at the beach or in the gym. I've seen a few people in the gym with look like suspicious lesions.
I'll just take off my shirt, Murray.
And I've had this debate with other doctors. About the view, I've been involved for many years with the Jewish Medical Doctors. It's called Australian Jewish Medical Federation. And we have conferences and we have debates. And some doctors say, well, when somebody comes up to you in the street, and they ask you a question, you should decline to answer because you don't know all the circumstances. Whereas I take the opposite view. We have this debate, what should you do when somebody asks you something? And you've got to remember, and this is one of the things that I do teach a little bit about, is that people, when a doctor says something, people take it quite seriously. And you can sometimes say something you think, oh, it's only a little thing, bit of help you've given, like say, name a specialist they can go to, and they'll remember for life if it's successful. But if the patient has a cancer and you say the wrong words, they're never going to forgive you. You say you have to be very careful how you talk to people.
Well, I think I know a friend who's a doctor, and he met this colleague of another friend, and he looked at his face. He said, I don't like that thing growing on your face now. And he went to the doctor, and it was a melanoma, and it was quite advanced, and he saved his life. So so you have those stories all the time, I imagine. And so in a way you're taking a stand, aren't you, if you're stepping forward and offering people free advice?
Yeah. Not like lawyers.
but do people come up to you in the street and show
well,
show
he's
you
not
there.
Wearing a sign saying I'm a
no,
doctor.
No, but they know him. He's in Carlisle Street, he's in Ackland Street, he's Harry.
Well,
he's a free consultation.
I've even had a lady show me a hernia in shul. In the hall, by the way, not inside this. Not during the service.
What, was it reducible, though?
Well, in actual fact, she'd had advice by another surgeon not to have it operated on.
From another shul?
No, I don't think it was a Jewish surgeon. And I said, well, this is ridiculous. She was in a lot of pain. I think you should get it operated on. So she went to my colleague and he fixed it up.
Under local anaesthetic, I
Under
imagine.
Under local anaesthetic.
There you go. We know what to do next. Okay, so you have people coming up to you. I think it is a very interesting question as a health professional. What is your responsibility for a total stranger? Are you saying that some of your colleagues would not go up to someone that they saw with clearly something that might be a bit dodgy?
I can't answer that because I don't know what they do.
Mm.
But I know some are against that concept.
Okay.
Yeah.
Overstepping.
Yeah.
What's
because
your,
you don't
I've
know.
Got
the problem
nothing
is
to
you,
add. I think
the
if
problem
they have,
is you don't know all the facts.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
You might be the 15th doctor that's gone up to them who said the same thing.
By that time, they need to go and see a doctor.
Yeah.
That's advice
if
you can give.
If you get free advice,
go and see a doctor.
Or you can give them your card.
I'm
joking.
If you get free advice, you should take it, I think, regardless.
So in terms of skin cancers, so early detection is obviously most critical. And there's also some other things that you can do for skin cancers in terms of dietary things and lifestyle. And I think it's even related to the diet that you would put someone on hemorrhoids on, in terms of having more fiber in the diet and just in general, the ways to reduce your risks of cancer. There's a lot of lifestyle medicine around that, which you're not interested in.
I don't know about the effect on skin cancer. I don't know that there's anything. But what is... there are other skin cancer conditions called where you get multiple moles, dysplastic nevus syndrome, where and it runs in families, and those patients need to be followed carefully because one of the moles might transform to a cancer. So they, and of course now we have photography and clinical photography and very good imaging machines, so you can go for a yearly checkup, have a photo, and the machine can detect any change. So, look, melanoma kills people. By the way, it's interesting, of course, that there are new treatments evolved, and I'm not an expert in them, but for example, patients like people like Gerard Ruffhead, he had a melanoma, I believe, on his lip. No, I'm not talking out. This is public knowledge. Yes. And he had it excised, and it recurred in his lung. And melanoma can be so advanced that you can't have it cut out. It's an advanced stage. I'm not sure whether he had it cut out again, but anyway, he went on to what's called immunotherapy and targeted therapy. These are the new drugs which treat different, A, melanoma, but they are used for lung cancer and other cancers now, and there are continuing advances in these. They do have some side effects, these are usually managed by oncologists who are experts in this, and fortunately, the prognosis for melanoma has improved with the addition of these cases. So the earlier you diagnose a melanoma, the early melanomas can all be cured. But if they leave it and it's thick, then there's a higher death rate.
I just want to add something about the research into the role of diet, dietary supplements and natural prevention and treatment of skin cancers, just in terms of what data there is. And there hasn't been that much work that's been done. But in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2015, they did a randomized controlled trial of nicotinamide for skin cancer chemo prevention, and they found that it had protective effects, as well as studies have been done into omega-3 fatty acids, green tea, and as well as grapeseed extract. So if you want to know a little bit about the research science, and these are all published in peer-reviewed journals, one of my favourite doctors in this area is a guy called Ray Sahelian. That's RaySahelian.com. And what he does is he brings together all the science around how do you bring in the natural treatment around things like skin cancer, which you wouldn't necessarily think that there are things you can do from a dietary perspective. So there you go.
Thank you for letting me know.
I'll send you the link.
Not Maurie's expertise there, Eva.
I think that's part of the trying to bring things together and have a more holistic approach to things and less fragmentation and more connectivity.
Well, you just got to feel good.
You've
got to feel good, don't you? We've got a few minutes left. What other wonderful topic could we...
Ingrown toenails. Oh, yeah. I think there's a family member, and I won't mention their name, who has got an ingrown toenail at the moment. So this is for you, in case you're listening. Mm. What do you do with an ingrown toenail?
Well, the commonest ones I saw were in adolescents, usually boys, wearing tight shoes. And what happens is mother or the child cuts the nail incorrectly, so there's a little spike in the corner which eats into the flesh of the skin and causes pain or infection. Now, I do know general practitioners who treat this condition conservatively by using antiseptics and a brush and this and that, and they say they never had to refer a patient off for surgery. However, by the time they used to come to me, they required surgery. And there's different types of surgery. For the acute infection, that you could have antibiotics. And then under a nerve block, and of course, nerve blocks are a bit painful, the injection. And often during the surgery, I'd have to be more concerned about the mother or the relative standing nearby fainting than the actual patient. Because even nurses became very squeamish at the sight of an ingrown toenail operation. So one of the simple things a GP can do is remove the nail edge. That will cure the infection, and then you train the nail to grow correctly, and that will probably cure 80% of patients. Another technique is to use an acid on the cut-out part of the nail, and you burn the part that the nail grows from with phenol. And that's a very effective technique for 80% of patients. And then you may get a recurrence. And the other technique, which is the technique I used, and was what's called wedge resection. And to tell you the truth, I suppose if I was starting surgery again, I'd probably use a phenol ablation more because it's not as painful and the recovery is quicker. So, but the definitive operation is called a wedge resection, where you remove a wedge of the nail and a wedge of the underlying skin.
Mm-hmm.
So the advice there is to see podiatrists more often, I suppose, and
it's to see a doctor.
Okay, don't wear shoes that often.
Okay.
Yeah.
How often?
Now, some countries, and we did discuss what we're going to talk about. We didn't talk about some of the other things I did.
Yes.
Which was go to Fiji. And I'm only going to tell you this story.
Okay.
Because it does have a relevance to Israel, where I have a daughter living and we visit on a regular basis. And I actually worked as a volunteer in 1967 in Ashkelon in the Barzilay Hospital, when it was a very small hospital. Now it was quite an extensive with an underground compartment, air raid, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I went to teach in Fiji, the professor there was a colleague of mine. He invited me to come for a couple of weeks. So we saw the patients who had hernias and other scrotal conditions that I was going to operate on and take the registrar or a surgeon in training through the techniques. And the first day, they took me on a ward round, and it was very interesting. I had a whole group of doctors. Next day, I'm giving a tutorial, and one of the doctors says to me, "Are you Jewish?" I said, "Yes." He said, and he didn't say anything else. So I didn't take any notice. He just asked me. So then the next day, we're doing it again. So he says to me, "You know, if you're Jewish, have you ever been in a war in Israel?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I've got some slides. I'll show you." And I said, "Why do you ask?" He said, "Because, you know, in Fiji, we like Israel. The Fijians provide the United Nations forces." So I was very chuffed that these people in Fiji had recognised Israel and had some feelings for Israel.
Mm.
So I found that quite interesting. The other interesting thing that I noticed in Fiji, and because I went there a few times teaching, was there were Chinese boats in the harbour. And so I asked my colleague, "What's going on here?" He says, "Well, we're not sure what they're doing. They've been here for quite a while." And this was a time when Australia had suspended relationships with Fiji.
Yep. Yep.
And I thought, this is crazy. Australia not. Anyway, I met the health minister and he introduced me to the American ambassador. And they said, "Oh, we got American Independence Day. Come along. You can represent Australia. There's no diplomats here. So you can come along and say you're Australian." Anyway, that was my small contribution to diplomatic affairs.
Good on you.
Was that before their Belt and Road Initiative in Fiji? So this would have been before that?
Yes. It was before.
Well, that's about it, Eva, I think, for this week.
Well, Maurie, thank you so much. And really, I'd love to hear from people if anyone decides to go to their doctor after listening to this and do something about that thing that they've been ignoring or avoiding for some time. If in terms of your own health, what's the number one advice that you would give to our listeners about keeping yourself healthy and out of the surgical knife?
Get a checkup.
Get a checkup. What excellent advice.
And, I must say, as a doctor myself, I must say, I won't go into all my different illnesses, but I must say, every time I have an illness, I learn a lot more about it.
That's so
myself.
True.
I understand it much better.
I feel blessed that my family have been so unwell. Started young.
On that note, hey,
thank you so much.
Thanks, Eva. Thanks, Maurie.
Thank you, Maurie, for joining us. Thank you, Sian.
Bye.